Five, four, three, two,
poop.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6.
We're going to Venus, Venus. It's the final countdown.
You know, when I was in high school, I thought I was gay for liking that song.
Dude, our jazz band did it in high school, and it kicked fucking ass.
Yeah, it's just like, apparently everybody loved it and was just, you know, keeping it secret.
Yes.
Kind of like Don't Stop Believing, you know, everyone. Nobody would go out and openly say before Guitar Hero and Rock Band that jerk fucking rule.
Dude, stay
the Sopranos, yeah.
I haven't actually seen more than two episodes of The Sopranos.
It's the final episode, yeah. Makes use of that song.
The loser still has the best use of that song.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's record this biatch.
Yo, record has been pressed.
All right. Hello, and welcome to another episode of They Came From the North, your weekly Canadian podcast about directors and movies and everything else. We're trying once again to do an episode about Tim Burton, the last one having been lost in the ether. Tim Burton, before I do my intro, I'll introduce my compadres. From Newfoundland, John Mercer.
How's it going, guys?
And Steve Power.
Time is money to a guy like me.
And our token American from Boston, Mr. Michael McVeigh.
I was born ready. Roll!
So we should also probably note that despite being American, Michael is, you know, he's a Yankee. He's very much in the northern part of the United States.
Yeah.
So he fits in pretty well.
He's not from Georgia or Texas like some other people we know.
Oh, no. It begins.
Although I really want to do a special episode called They Came From the Bayou.
All right. So Tim Burton was born in Burbank, California in 1958. He developed very early an interest in movies and especially animation. He started his career working on Disney as a storyboard and concept artist for films like The Fox and the Hound, The Black Cauldron, and Tron. He also made a short film called Vincent about his hero, Vincent Price, and a live-action short called Frankenweenie. Then, after Paul Rubens saw Frankenweenie, he hired Tim Burton to direct the big-screen adventures of Pee-wee. In 1985, which was a budget of $8 million and scored $40 million at the box office, which really established Burton as a force to be reckoned with. He then made Beetlejuice for the same, which grossed $80 million on a relatively low budget as well. Due to that success, it would be handed the reins to the biggest film event of the 1980s, 1989's Batman. After the huge success of that film, Burton would do probably his most personal film up to that point, Edward Scissorhands. Then back to Batman with Batman Returns. Then he would make a biopic after... about Ed Wood, the arguably worst filmmaker in the world, which performed poorly at the box office, but was well received by critics. Martin Landau scoring an Academy Award for his performance as Bela Lugosi. After Ed Wood, he would make Mars Attacks, the alien invasion parody with an ensemble cast. Then the horror film Sleepy Hollow, the remake of Planet of the Apes, Big Fish in 2003, another remake, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the animated film Corpse Bride, the big screen adaptation of Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street, Alice in Wonderland in 2010, and his last movie so far, Dark Shadows. So, with that said, let's start about with our good for Mr. Tim Burton. Let's go with Michael.
Ooh, interesting. Caught me off guard there. My good is going to have to be my personal favorite emotional, epic music, scissors, weird hair, German expressionism, Edward Scissorhands. I love that movie. I love it a lot.
Sleepy Hollow.
Or all of the above, except for... Yeah, I love Ed Wood. I've always loved it. It's a fairy tale for, you know, adults in which a...
You meant Edward Scissorhands, right?
You said
Ed Wood, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I love that movie too. and he's got a penchant for Eds as well. That sounded delicious. What do you call it?
Give me Ed till I'm dead.
Yeah, I think the thing that really killed me about this movie was the music. You know, Danny Elfman and Tim Burton's relationship stretches all the way back to, I believe it's Danny Elfman's possibly second score. After, I think he scored his brother's movie. I'm not really sure, but.
Yeah, the weirdo for flick. I don't remember what it was called with Irvin Vilches.
Yeah. Involving hell and very interesting stuff. But this was his Danny Elfman's first real, I think, Hollywood film. If you can consider Pee Wee Herman a big Hollywood film. And, you know, they had great success in the following movies, Beetlejuice and Batman, of course, is legendary.
Beetlejuice was actually before Edward.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm talking about Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah.
It's my favorite.
Yeah, but, I mean, Beetlejuice came earlier in their relationship, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, 88. And then you had Batman, then you had Edward Scissorhands, which is just this sensitive, wonderful score that is often imitated, never duplicated. It popped up in a series of something similar. I feel like there was a series of Nissan commercials in the 90s that I believe they had used temp music from Edward Scissorhands and just said, hey, we're Nissan, we got money. Let's just hire Danny Elfman to compose the exact same thing but different. And so the score really, really is, you know, it's up there for me. It's just a beautiful, delicate, you know, like constantly, very, 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 you know, I guess before Danny Elfman started sitting in the pocket in films, he was really up there, really out front, you know, with his idiosyncratic style. And Ed Wood, I think, epitomizes that for me. I mean, it's got, you know, not only that, it's got. Is this the first Johnny Depp collaboration?
Yeah.
The birth of that monster right there. one of the last performances from Vincent Price, if not the last.
I think it's the last. Yeah.
Some just really amazing art direction, of course. You know, just a really simple story about you know, somebody who's lonely. And who can identify with that?
I can.
Well, you're so darn popular. I mean, that's you're the exception. But growing up, I mean, I really identify with this movie. You know, the sensitive artist kind of thing going on. You know, definitely didn't get the girl. I guess you could consider him, you know, like a wistful, creepy stalker, in a way. He does murder a man in cold blood at the end.
And there's a certain sense of whimsy and just plain fun that Burton somehow has lost during the years. That's there in Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah, he had that. He definitely has I love Tim Burton had a great sense of humor, especially in his earlier films. I mean, Pee-wee is hilarious. And, you know, I mean, well, you can make arguments against that, but you know, Beetlejuice is wacky and fun. Even Batman, you know, had its good sense of humor, and Ed Wood has that too, personified by Alan Arkin, who is the embodiment of the tone of Ed Wood to me. You know, he's just
Edward Scissorhands.
In Edward Scissorhands, Alan Arkin is just amazing and embodies Ed Wood. Like, what I mean by that is that Alan Arkin's performance in Edward Scissorhands is like the entirety of Ed Wood condensed into one performance. just go back and watch Edward Scissorhands and just hone in on Alan Arkin. He is hilarious. He is just so funny. He just deadpan rolls right through. I mean, remember that scene where Ed just almost gets raped by the Ted Bundy impersonator? Yeah, definitely. And he goes to the dinner and he's describing the whole scene, and then he just kind of Ed just kind of offhandedly states, and then she took all her clothes off. Alan Arkin does not miss a beat. He's like, "Well, that's great, Ed. You're gonna learn all this experience." It's just such a perfect performance, you know, comedic performance. Winona Ryder just looking gorgeous. I mean, this movie is really great for me. What do you guys think of Edward Scissorhands?
I gotta say, I'm not a big fan. It's not my thing. It's not a movie I ever really got, I guess. I always just found it to be, and I mean, I was a little more hard on it during take one, you know, but to me, it's just a freak show. I could never really, I guess I could never wrap my head around the real freak show movies, like the real awkward, completely crazy, kind of offbeat stuff, like the stuff that almost feels...
Quick question for you.
Yeah?
What did you see first, Edward Scissorhands or Repo Man?
It would have been Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, I don't know. I never really, like, the movie never got me. Even when it was a new release, a lot of people, like, my age were into it. And, like, my girlfriend at the time really loved it. And I just kind of, you know, I was watching it and, you know, all the multicolored houses and stuff. And, I mean, like, maybe a lot of it is my upbringing. You know, I'm an 80s Reagan kid. I watched a lot of action movies. You know, while other kids were watching Sesame Street and whatever else, I was watching Lethal Weapon and Die Hard, you know. Like, there wasn't really any parental control in my house. And more often than not, when I did watch these movies, I was watching them with Dad. So, you know, I guess when I tried to go to Edward Scissorhands, I was still kind of in that frame of mind where I liked stuff like Die Hard or Lethal Weapon or one of these, like, big action movies because they felt more real to me, I guess, whereas Edward Scissorhands was just so fantastical and so strange.
Well, it's straight up fantasy. I mean, it's bookended with Winona Ryder in that aged makeup, which isn't half bad actually. You know, telling a story to, you know, a very 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 tiny little girl in a very oversized bed with giant pillows, you know, and it's just her little head's popping out and it's lit just so. And you know, and then
that's I think I just,
you know, the tale. Go ahead.
I think Burton's visual style just throws me off. Mm-hmm. I don't like it. I think that's what it all boils down to. It rubs me the wrong way. Like, it's just, it's esoteric and weird.
And in a way, I mean, Edward Scissorhands is probably, you know, it's the most. If anybody never heard of Tim Burton and. Like, that's the movie I would use to introduce them to him, because it's so Burton.
Yeah. It very much is, like, an identifier. And, I mean, Nightmare Before Christmas, even though he didn't direct it, it has that same, that Burton-esque look. And, I mean, it's popped up 8 million times. Like, it's been so imitated with, like, stuff like Gloom and all of this stuff, you know. And it just, I wasn't a fan of the art style the first time around when it was, you know, when it was Edward Scissorhands or Beetlejuice or Nightmare Before Christmas. And it just, that particular aesthetic, that whole comic goth aesthetic just does not appeal to me at all in the slightest. And I think that's the biggest turn off for me.
That's valid. I mean, yeah. Have you seen Dr. Caligari? Have you ever seen the,
I have.
He's definitely, I mean, Edward Scissorhands looks just like Caesar in that.
Yeah, but Burton has taken that vibe or whatever, but he just cranks it so far beyond the norm, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, love the movie or hate the movie, what do you think of Depp in the movie?
A little too aloof for me. I found I couldn't relate to him. I found he was just too puppy-like or something. I don't know, Depp's performance, and I'm sure that's how it was intended. You know, the guy is a social misfit and all is fine. But I don't slight Depp or Burton for it, but I just personally couldn't relate with that character at all. I found his performance more alienating.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's definitely, I think, a divisive guy, and if you don't get Edward Scissorhands, it's probably just because Burton's not for you, right?
Yeah.
I love Edward Scissorhands. It's it's so good. I it's a movie I can definitely relate to easily, but I think it's so very personal, you know? It's the type of movie I don't think there's any middle ground for that movie. People who are just meh, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, it is a polarizing film. I guess if you're falling on the side of the fence, I guess it would be easy to kind of emo-ize Edward Scissorhands or however you want to say that, you know, making him a very sensitive protagonist. But I guess for me, I grew up in. My mother was an Avon lady, and Diane Beast in the movie is an Avon lady. I mean, it hits all these beats, you know. I grew up in a development, you know, although in a rural part of the country in upstate New York, but, you know, I mean, the neighborhood, was not too far off from, I mean, it's definitely not Burbank. It's not cookie cutter or anything like that. We got woods and all this good stuff, but, you know, I mean, that kind of, you know, your neighbors and that sense of community and gossip and that kind of thing, that was there, you know, I mean, for me, and that made it easier to relate to, mm-hmm. in a way.
And I think that to come back to what I was saying about personal, I mean, that movie is so much about, you know, childhood and stuff that it really depends on how you grew up and how you viewed the world from a young age, you know? And if you're not that type of person who sees himself as an outsider or something, maybe you won't relate to it.
Yeah, or you could identify with Anthony Michael Hall. You know, breaking into your dad's place and having that disciplinarian father, you know.
It's a bit of a weird one for me. Edward Scissorhands, I saw it the weekend it came out on VHS. Which I always remember. I think it must have been late June because it was around my birthday.
Yeah.
And because I do believe the theater was a Christmas movie, was it not?
It was, yeah.
Yeah. And I think a big part of the disappointment for me, it's one of those movies I haven't seen it since that weekend. Mm. I have had absolutely no desire to revisit it whatsoever. And I remember a lot of the ad campaign was based around, you know, the director of Beetlejuice and Batman wants you to meet his latest creation.
Yeah, I've seen that trailer, yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of, you know, so I mean, and we'll get into Batman a little bit later, but Batman was just, I have vivid memories of seeing that in theater. And then you go to something like Edward Scissorhands and, you know, probably because Burton had those couple big hits, he was able to do, you know, Batman gave him his license to Earth, right? Mm-hmm. He could make whatever the hell he wanted after making a movie that brought in close to $500 million in 1989 money.
Yeah, big money.
Yeah, but I don't know, just Edward Scissorhands felt like I went in expecting something a little more comic and getting just this, you know, weirdo fairy tale.
Yeah.
It's And I don't know. I've never gone back to it, and it's a bit weird because my wife's a bit of a Burton fan, you know, as far as her knowledge of directors goes. And
Sarah is totally a Burton fan. I think Burton is a chick director.
Yeah. Like, cause, I mean, like, Beth is into that whole, what was it called a few years ago? Emily the Strange.
Yeah.
And all that, you know, that's still like, Beth would buy t-shirts at Hot Topic. And, yeah, it's just something I've had absolutely no desire to ever go back to. And that's the way a lot of Burton's movies are to me, outside of this precious handful. It's just, you know, this whole fire and forget type deal. You go in, and, you know, he's a strong visualist. He's got a very, very quirky design aesthetic. And I'll freely admit that he probably misses Anton First a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, you've got this... He's got this unique visual style, and, you know, outside of what Steve was bringing up, the Ruby Gloom stuff, and I just said, you know, the Hot Topic and the Emily the Strange stuff, all of that kind of came from Burton.
Mm.
Or, you know, at least it being popular definitely gets traced back to Tim Burton. And but Edward Scissorhands is just something I've never, ever felt the desire to ever revisit.
You know what's interesting?
And the things that always stick out the strongest to me in the movie, well, I hated the whole, even when I was 8 years old, I hated the every magazine you'd flip through, Edward was hair. The picture of the chicks with the bouffant hairstyles. And the, I always hated that, but the, I just totally lost my train of thought. I always vividly remember the him killing Anthony Michael Hall,
mm-hmm.
right? Because he's like, oh, shit, this crappy movie just got hardcore.
He didn't just kill him. He murdered him.
Yeah.
Very, very
like,
much
he, doesn't
so.
He, like, run him through and then boot him out of window?
Runs him right through.
Yeah. And I always remember the... When I was a kid, I was deathly afraid of skeletons, despite my absolute love for Ray Harryhausen. I used to hate skeletons in movies. You know, like watching Tot's face melt off in Raiders of the Lost Ark left me with nightmares for months. One of the few things besides skeletons that ever really disturbed me, and because I was like Steve, you know, I watched a lot of action movies with my dad, and, you know, I was an 80s kid, so it was all G.I. Joe and laser guns and robots and ninjas and all that awesome stuff. And something that always disturbed me was just the look on Vincent Price's face right before he dies in that movie. After, you know, Edward kind of inadvertently destroys the hands he's made. And that's something, I suppose that's something you could say about, you know, Burton's visual style and that, is despite having not seen the movie since 1991,
I can still
vividly remember that image.
Mm-hmm.
The way I feel about this movie is I know that it's got to be. I mean, just looking at, just watching it, it feels very autobiographical
mm-hmm.
about Tim Burton. And I think Gabriel touched on it earlier. It's almost like a litmus test for how you feel about Burton in general. You know, how you said, Gabriel, if you were going to introduce somebody to the works of Tim Burton, that you'd start with Edward Scissorhands because it embodies the you know, those qualities that you see so much in Tim Burton films. There's a house, I think, getting sprayed for potato bugs or whatever. It's got the stripes on it.
Mm.
You know, you have the Johnny Depp protagonist with the ghostly, ghoulish kind of pale skin and the black, outfit and basically you have the imagery of this, like, looming absurd castle in the middle of suburbia. You know, so you have this, like, just, it's almost an embodiment of.
There's a certain kind of magical realism, too. And I think often people, you know, they concentrate on the art design and they forget that Tim Burton has a definite way of directing that's very recognizable with the, like, the sweeping camera moves. You know, he's got a very free-flowing cameras at some points. And he definitely knows how to compose a shot. I remember this is probably like the first DVD I ever bought, or the second around there. And you could switch between full screen and widescreen. And it's really like, just I played around just to see, and it was so obvious which one was the better, you know.
I also like to add that in great moments, I work at a sign company, and great moments in movie signage. One of them is Edward Scissorhands, the bank scene, the exterior shot of the bank that's clearly like some kind of mall or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's this big blank wall and it just says bank. And you go down and you go inside.
That was subliminal advertising, man, because after Batman, that's what the studio wanted, was to make bank.
Or I think it might be the first time that, like, the 20th Century Fox allowed its logo to be changed.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The snowy 20th Century, yeah.
Not entirely true. I do believe Cannonball Run, they put cartoon cars on it.
They did.
And I do think they did something with it for Revenge of the Nerds as well.
Well, then I have been mistaken my whole life.
see that, Gabe? Pow!
You heard it live, ladies and gentlemen. Gentlemen.
All right, so John...
Don't listen to this.
John, what would be your pick for good?
Okay, I'm going to go out on a limb here now and assume that Steve's got the same good as me.
What ever gave you that idea, Jeff?
Because there's really only one choice. Do you want to say it at the count of three?
One, two, three.
Sleepy Hollow. Sleepy Hollow to me, and I don't really know what it is about it. It kind of treads this really cool middle ground where it's the least Burton-esque of the Tim Burton movies, yet it's instantly recognizable as being Tim Burton.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've always dug how... I'm really glad he directed that, what, 96, 97?
97?
What, Sleepy Hollow?
Yeah.
Sleepy Hollow with
what
99.
What do you mean,
99?
99. Really glad that came a little bit later in his career, because prior to Sleepy Hollow, Tim Burton was, pardon my French, Gabe, the shits as an action director.
He was.
The guy could not, yeah, like, he's got great visual style, and we already spoke about the sweeping camera movements and everything. Guy could not direct an action scene to save his life.
Oh, you didn't like that scene in Batman where the ninja comes flying over the fence?
More on Batman later. More on the spring-loaded hand spatula later. Because I've got things to say about Batman. But... Sleepy Hollow, I don't know, it's got these great little punctuation marks done with gore in it, right?
Mm-hmm. These great beheadings.
Yes, you know, the beheadings that are early. Casper Van Dien, awesome.
Oh, yeah, Clefting Twain, right? Who said that?
I said it,
that's a Steve reference.
That's a Howard classic right there, isn't it? Clefting Twain. Right?
I stole that from Steve on the Long Lost Tim Burton podcast.
Yeah, Johnny Rico was hewn asunder in that scene.
Those bugs came nothing on Christopher Walken.
Now, Sleepy Hollow just kind of it looks Burton-esque without having to go nuts with the stripes and spirals and instantly recognizable, just, you know, really, really in your face with the beheadings.
Just to defend the stripes, any Christina Ricci dress in any given scene is stripe-alicious.
And this also will tell you how Burton's a little bit more of a mature filmmaker at this point. Christina Ricci has blonde hair in Sleepy Hollow.
Just like Winona Ryder in Edward Scissorhands.
She doesn't have an inky raven black 40s Betty Page hairstyle. Or a bob cut.
Or like, what's her name in Planet of the Apes? There's a blonde in there.
Marla Singer.
Not Helena Bonham. In Planet of the Apes, there was a
supermodel. I can't be bothered to remember her name.
Exactly.
Estella Warren or something?
Yes, it was. And I think she was supposed to be that film's version of Nova, which makes me very sad. I don't know. Sleepy Hollow just always stood out to me. It's an awesome movie. I never did get to see it in theater.
I did.
Well, I mean, it was, you know, the weekend I rented it on VHS. I didn't have a DVD player yet at that point. I probably watched it 4 or 5 times.
No kidding. It was
awesome.
I love Sleepy Hollow so much. The reason I consider it Burton's best is because it's that one really shining example for me of where his sensibilities, his idiosyncratic style really suits the subject matter. Mm-hmm. You know, it really nails the tone. It really sells the atmosphere incredibly well. And because...
Oh, dude, it's like a punk rock retelling of a witch hunt.
Yeah.
Right?
But beyond that, like, it's even... You get the mythology, like, you know, the legend of Ichabod Crane or whatever, you know, from the Disney version. And, he clearly used that as his starting point and then went harder with it. You know, like, he took the adventures of Ichabod and filtered it through 60s and 70s Hammer horror, you know? Mm-hmm. And then he loaded it with these really amazing classicist actors, you know, these real character actors like Michael Goff. You know, like he had all of these really great faces and just...
It was fantastically, fantastically acted.
Yeah. It was just, for me, the only thing, I said it last week, I kind of had reservations that Van Dien was kind of shortchanged. Because I like Van Dien as an actor, and the few little scenes he did have...
What?
I do. I like Van Dien as an actor. And
does he know he's an actor?
I don't think he's really aware of the fact. But
he knows he's a producer.
He does. But no, I like that, you know, when he first comes into the movie, he kind of... You can tell this is, you know, the alpha male who feels really bruised by Ichabod's intellect and stuff, you know? And he's got that real kind of...
Yeah.
Very standoffish attitude, and nothing ever really comes of it. Nothing ever pays off, you know, until the scene where he dies. And I don't know, like, I think he deserved a little better. I think that character and the way he portrayed it, he deserved a little more.
Well, to be fair, that screenplay has some problems.
Yeah, and, you know, it was a movie that you can tell based on the fact that the one trailer that was shown theatrically has more deleted scenes in it than actual footage from the film. You know?
Wasn't the Emperor from Star Wars in that?
Like, yep, he was. Yep.
And like unrecognizable and awesome.
Yep. And also
Christopher Lee, of course.
Yep. And Landau in the opening scene.
Yep.
Was awesome. Absolutely awesome. Yep.
Edward R. Rooney, yep. I think, is Jeffrey Jones.
Jeffrey Jones, yeah, he's in there. But like and Michael Goff, man, he was just so damn creepy in it. He's only in, you know.
Yes, that's where he's got the blind in one eye.
Yeah, and he's all hunched forward, and he's like the headless Hessian horseman. You know, like, raspy.
He looks like a classic Western undertaker.
Yeah, he's just a raspy old bastard, you know. And I think he actually was too the gravedigger or the caretaker or something like this, right? Like, but just great collection of characters, and everybody is just really like even Ricci, who's. You know, like, she is kind of a little bit of the weak link in the movie, but even her kind of, she's kind of giving it her all, you know?
Miranda Richardson more than makes up for it.
Oh, she's amazing. Great. Absolutely amazing. And Michael Gambon, man, he is on fire in this movie.
And to be fair to Ricci, she doesn't have much of a role to play.
She's the damsel.
Yeah. Although, again, this might this might have been something that was trimmed down quite a bit before it debuts, right?
And again, on top of that, even, you know, you get the, like you were saying, John, the action sequences. All the action sequences are freaking amazing in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm watching it and I'm thinking, this is a Tim Burton movie?
It, like, well, man, no, it looks like a Tim Burton movie, yet at the same time, it looks like whenever swords are drawn in the movie, John Woo suddenly like stuck his head over Tim's shoulder.
And I think another thing,
Tim, you really want to move the camera over there.
Another thing too that we didn't focus on much last week, but is definitely worth mentioning: the Headless Horseman himself, when not seen in flashback, is played by Ray Park, who also did.
Oh, no kidding!
He also did all the choreography, all the horsemen's choreography. So I mean, that
Beth met Ray Park. We've got an autographed picture of him down on the wall.
Nice.
Yeah, he's really short.
What happened to it when it got struck by lightning?
It's funny because it is an autographed picture of Toad.
Oh, poor thing. Oh man.
No, that just happened to be the pictures he had with him at the time, right? I think he was all out of Darth Maul. Because I think at that point, that's all Ray Park had was Darth Maul and Toad.
Well, he had.
I don't think he has to worry about his legacy there. I think Darth Maul is the best thing out of all the prequels there.
Yeah. So like now I'm upset because we should probably have an autographed picture of the Headless Horseman.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool. I didn't know that. That's really cool.
I meant to mention it last week, but I think we just got carried up in the conversation, and that was it. But yeah,
how'd they make him so giant?
Force perspective.
The horseman looks enormous, right?
That movie used so much force perspective. Everything is shot on a soundstage. It's all, you know, like they use little tiny, like the trees in the movie are actually tree branches. You know, it really is a classical film in every sense in how it's filmed, you know?
Beautiful.
Beautiful to watch. This was Lost Ages from last week, too. You're from that part of the woods.
I am.
Have you ever seen any? What was the tree called in Sleepy Hollow?
The vagina tree.
Yeah, the vagina. Yeah. Have you ever seen a vagina tree in your life?
A gushing, bloody. I'm gonna have to say negatory.
The vagina is tomato botus.
Although I
trees
I,
in upstate New York do not make vampire tea bags.
Well, I think That movie took place over by Terrytown, and I mean that's all Westchester County now. That's some very wealthy, well off county in New York, close to New York.
Isn't that where the X-Men live?
Yep, that's correct. Yeah, Westchester County, right? And you know, I'm from the other side of the Hudson River, where we actually still have a lot of the, you know, the woods and the trees and you know that sort of thing. And, you know, you still go over there, you still cross the Tappan Zee Bridge, you know, over to Westchester there, and they take that very seriously. It's an economic thing over there. You know, they do little festivals and whatnot.
Creepy tree festivals.
But yeah, Sleepy Hollow is really a great October flick.
I was, when I was doing research for this, I was distraught to find that we don't own it.
I do.
I was downstairs, I said, man, I can't wait to put in Sleepy Hollow. I haven't watched it in years. I said, there's a reason I haven't watched it in years.
Yeah. I think the like, one of the things with Sleepy Hollow, me, I know when I saw it in theater, it was a girl that I was dating at the time. When at that point in time, we had seen absolutely everything that played on a movie theater screen in St. John's. So, you know, we'd seen Sleepy Hollow, and I believe that night we saw two movies. We went and saw Sleepy Hollow and The Messenger, I think. And then flash forward, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 months, and I'm with Sarah, and she buys her first DVD player, and it's one of the first 4 movies we buy. And I think that week we watched it maybe 5 times, 6 times.
Nice.
But I remember showing it to, like myself and Sarah. I had rented it on VHS the Tuesday it came out. And we watched it that night, and then I think it was like maybe Wednesday we went out, we bought the DVD player, and we bought a copy of Sleepy Hollow, watched it on DVD that night, so it was like, oh, look how pretty it is. And then a friend of mine, really good friend of mine, Russ, hadn't seen it, and we had to sit down and watch it with him, and you know, it was just, we ended up watching it, I think, 6 or 7 times that week, just showing it to different people, and everybody loved it.
How about that Johnny Depp there?
He was great. He was really great in Sleepy Hollow.
Mm-hmm.
I probably consider that his most effective performance, to be honest with you.
Really?
Well, you know, Johnny Depp was made at this point. Not made, I should say. But Johnny Depp was, you know, when the time Edward Scissorhands came around, I think part of the reason Edward was so weird, and I think a big part of the reason he became such fast friends with Tim Burton, is Depp was desperate to escape the fate of a Tiger Beat cover boy, right?
Yeah, that whole teen heartthrob thing.
Yeah, because, I mean, well, Depp had, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, and then in the late 80s, right into 21 Jump Street.
Yeah.
And I think he was, I don't think words can even describe how desperate he was to escape that.
Well, I mean, he'd had his reputation as being something of a character actor, like one of those guys who just popped up. But
yeah.
Sleepy Hollow was, like, I mean, right at the beginning of his real rise to fame. Like, he had really started to kind of become a name. You had Sleepy Hollow and the Ninth Gate, and, you know, and then, well, of course, Pirates came a few years later, and that was it. Then it was all, you know.
Pirates came after the failure of the Ninth Gate and the Astronaut's Wife nearly snuffed the career of Johnny Depp.
Yeah. We'll always have Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
That's no better way to do it than like a Tim Burton version of a Hammer horror film.
Yeah,
you know, that was some good stuff.
We were talking earlier about Casper's exit from that movie, and you know how like he comes on screen and you're thinking this is the foil for Ichabod, and this guy's going to die at minute 118 of 125 minute long.
Correct. Yeah, right?
That is very much a Hammer moment, his exit out of the movie. It's just, and that's kind of, you know, lay the cards on the table. No one is safe.
Yeah.
Right?
The rug has been pulled, right? I remember seeing that on a vacation, actually, in the summer. I believe it was a summer picture. And I remember
Thanksgiving.
It was
American Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Huh.
Oh, I remember the whole tagline of the poster was "This Thanksgiving heads will roll."
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, I remember that.
I remember going into the theater and having a completely immersive experience, and then walking out of the theater and it just being completely like just where was I for the last 2 hours? You know, I was in a different time. In a different place. It really established that for me, even though it's full of...
We crossed the bridge.
Yeah.
All right. For my good, as much as I love Edward Scissorhands, and as much as I would probably select Edward as Tim Burton's flick, best film, for me, there's only one choice, and I know it's crazy, but it has to be Batman Returns.
That's a great movie.
It is such. I mean, this is Burton being given free reign on the Batman franchise after he made so much money with the first one, and it's so very much a Tim Burton film. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you have the darkness and the griminess of the Batman universe. Thrown in there, and there's so much weird stuff, and I like just all dark and sadistic and weird it just gets, and oh, Danny DeVito in this movie just he rules.
I'm gonna leave the room for a couple minutes. When do you guys text me when Gabe's done?
We'll be talking about German Expressionism and you know, Metropolis and things like that for the time being, so don't worry about it. We'll fill you in later.
And I think the movie is wonderfully cast, and it gets the tone all right. And I know a lot of people complain about giving the villains too big of roles, but I think in this universe, he wants to use... I know Burton probably doesn't like Batman that much, but I think in his view, it makes sense to not use him that much, because then Batman, he retains his force of surprise, you know, and his imposing presence and not being in the movie that much.
It also ruins the fact that it's a Batman movie.
No, what ruins the fact that it's a Batman movie is Batman's a cold-blooded murderer.
Yeah, not just a murderer. It's not like, you know, punching the Joker off the end of a cathedral. If I remember correctly, Batman Returns, he sticks a bomb down some guy's pants. he pulls open the front of the guy's pants and just, like, crams his arm down there, elbow deep with a giant, like, old dynamite with an alarm clock strapped to it.
Oh, man.
You know, classic.
Isn't there also, like, spinning blades of death ejected from the Batmobile into the abdomens of motorcycle riders?
Dude, at one point, the fire-breathing devil guy.
Roast him alive.
The rocket engine on the Batmobile.
But in a way, that's what I find interesting about that movie, is that Batman is as psychotic and as damaged as the villain he's pursuing.
It's not a canon, but hey, the big draw for that movie, other than, you know, Danny Elfman again, is Michelle Pfeiffer.
That's
so sexy.
Woman. Oh yeah.
Having read the original screenplay for Batman Returns, I gained new appreciation for the Catwoman costume they actually went with, which was a much better choice than the gimp mask in the
And talking about the costume, I have to mention one of my favorite scenes that I mentioned last week, and it's this parallel editing technique where you see Bruce Wayne going in his Batcave, and he has like 1,000 suits ready, and it puts a self on him and whatever. He doesn't have to do much work. Well, you see Selina Kyle like using her machine to. What's the word I'm looking
for? To repair the Catwoman costume.
Yeah, to make the Catwoman costume together. It's just so the two different lifestyles put against each other. I mean, there's so many great moments in this movie. I know it's not rational to love it, but I love it.
When has that ever stopped any of us?
Yeah. To tell you the truth, somebody like myself who unabashedly loves and craves the films of Hal Needham, I'm not going to hold a grudge against Gabe for enjoying Batman Returns. That being said, as somebody who grew up with Batman comics, you know, in the late 80s, I hate Batman Returns. I hate Schumacher movies, but I hate Batman Returns.
I just hate what they did to the villains in those movies. I hate how they.
Dude, I hate what they did to the. You know, I hate the whole gothic statues everywhere. Gotham is 1970s New York. It's not German expressionism. It's a shithole. Okay, it's corrugated steel, rust everywhere, slime on every visible surface, right?
Well,
is a shithole.
I got into Batman comics due to, like, The Long Halloween and Grant Morrison's Arkham Asylum, so my view's a bit skewed.
Oh, no, man. I grew up with the, I believe it was Dennis O'Neill.
Neil Adams and Denise.
No, even Neil Adams had kind of hung up the pencil at that point, and you were starting to get all these artists like Kelly Jones.
Oh, yeah.
You know, right? And, you know, you were starting to get, they'll never pop up in comics anymore, but, I mean, like, I loved some of the villains he was up against in the late 80s. You know, I loved stuff like the whole KGB storyline and the...
He went over to Russia and all that stuff. Remember that? He went over and, like, saved Gorbachev and...
No, I don't remember. My KGB storyline was just a KGB hitman.
Yeah, let's move this along. We're talking about movies, not comic books.
Yeah.
Good point.
But, yeah, Batman Returns, I love it.
You don't love the Susie and the Banshee song, do you?
Yes, I do. I even love the Susie and the Banshee
song.
I
believe Gabriel even posted it on the
on my wall, yeah.
Facebook group for all
I'm like,
enjoyment.
I was like, I don't care what anyone says, I love this song.
But it just doesn't fit with Batman at all. Like, Prince is just so much more fitting.
With that said, I guess John could see you into his bad.
Yeah, let's get into my bad. And my bad, despite the strong memories I have for it, is the 1989 Batman. And, we say it every week, you know, our bad isn't technically a bad movie. It's just something we feel is fundamentally flawed.
However, in this case, you actually picked a bad movie.
Yeah, it isn't a great movie, and it has more flaws than good points. That movie came out the day before my 7th birthday. I remember going down to Sobey Square and standing in line up for what felt like 3 hours to go and see Batman. I can remember, you know, not being able to go anywhere. You couldn't leave your house between the months of February and the rest, well, actually from February right through to the end of 1989, you could not leave your house without seeing the bat symbol. You would run into 5 people with that t-shirt on, at least.
Yeah.
You know, restaurants. I had never seen before, nor have I ever seen since, just media saturation, even akin to what we saw with Batman. You know, I have, and at 7 years old, that movie was the shit. All right? It was awesome.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
At 3 years old, going back to it, it's the shits. Plural. Okay, it's not a great movie. And there's just so many things. There's stuff in it I really like, okay? Michael Keaton is Batman. Despite, outside of the whole Bela Lugosi arm raising shit he does every scene, I liked his Batman voice. He looked like a creepy son of a bitch. Michael Keaton's Bruce Wayne is horrible,
very very aloof and weird.
Yeah, just too weird.
I keep hanging upside down. Get it? I'm Batman. Ooh.
And that's one of the portrayal of Bruce Wayne in that movie is proof positive that Tim Burton never read a Batman comic before he set out to make the movie.
Yeah, he's not a fan of comics, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, but it's like you got this character who's, you know, driven and possibly borderline psychotic, but not a weirdo, right? The sleeping upside down thing and
the suits of armor.
The suits of armor outside of the awesome line of the, it's Japanese.
How do you know? Because I bought it in Japan.
Yeah.
Oh,
and that one line Japan. Right there was Bruce Wayne.
Yeah. That scene was great. I love that scene. But.
Yeah, after that it just gets, when you know, they kind of try to pry him open a little bit, let you get into the character a bit more. It's just, it's weird. It's really weird. And, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about Sleepy Hollow, how Burton got to fill the supporting cast up with these wonderful character actors and, you know, all the ancillary characters. They're all awesome. Batman is the complete opposite.
Oh, it's just a bunch of friggin' crazy, over-the-top A-listers chewing scenery.
It's every single character. It's just this big, thick, salty slice of ham.
Yeah.
I kind of like Pat Engel as Gordon.
Hold it right there!
Yeah, but you see, that was very much in the vein of the 60s Gordon. He's completely useless.
Yeah,
he's incompetent.
Yeah. You're full of shit, Knox.
Oh my god, and Porkins.
Porkins.
I can't remember, last week when we were doing this, did we find out his real name?
His real name is Hootkins, William Hootkins.
Okay, no, his name is Porkins.
His name is Porkins, it has to be. What else could it be?
Yeah, in death, a member of Project Mayhem gets a name, and his name is Porkins.
and of course...
Yeah, on the fangs, though.
But the best is still Bob.
Oh, yeah, Bob the Goon.
And the best part about Bob the Goon, this is one of the few, because I'm, you know, I can't, you can't go, for years, Nicholson's Joker was the alpha male of comic book movie villains.
No right? way.
Yeah. But you can't go back to him now.
Nicholson's Joker was obsolete in 1992.
Yeah. But it's just, he is, I'll tell you one thing, he's no Michael Wincott as top dollar.
No. But no, 1992, man, when Mark Hamill did that voice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Nicholson's
Sorry,
Joker was obsolete.
Hamill's
whole idea of what to do with the character, because he's not doing an English accent like everyone thinks. He's doing Connecticut Nouveau Riche. Right? That's what he said. He wanted to take this, you know, this person who is probably intelligent, and then just make him a fucking lunatic.
This will probably prove how crazy I am, but the last time I watched Batman, I was like, man, I forgot how good Nicholson was in this flick.
Nicholson, the last scene with Bob, after all the...
Bob,
gone.
Done.
That's
the closest he got to being the Joker.
I actually liked Nicholson before he transformed. I liked Nicholson in the mobster scenes.
The thing for me is I think he saw Cesar Romero and he was like, hey, I can just crank that up to 11.
Yeah.
You know, and then like, Palin saw that that Jack went to 11 and Palin said, I'm going to 947.
Jack,
you're lucky, Jack.
Okay, when they were filming Batman, Jack Palance was very much the Pierce Hawthorne of the group. And he is just, man, he is just reaching.
Beautiful.
The nasal inhalation is off the charts.
And then Jack spits it right back at Bob.
The biggest moment in that is his Palance impersonation.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You, I'm like on a walk. God.
But yeah, it's just, and right there, that was, you know, people talk about Batman Returns doing it. No, it happened in the first one.
And see, okay, John, we are proving everything that is wrong with Burton's Batman.
Yeah.
All we are talking about is Nicholson and Palance and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. Who are we not talking about?
Batman.
Exactly. Yeah. This is the problem with Burton's Bat films. They're Bat films. They should be about Batman. It's about
and the
Bruce
big
Wayne.
The other thing too is in 1989, Batman is on one hand it was exactly what comic book movies needed. It was that massive success, the proof that it could be an event, right? The late 70s Superman was not the exception, right? It could be done. On the other hand, it created the template for everything that was wrong with comic book movies until 2005.
Yeah, it did. And I mean, and on top of that, you can't look at that. You can't look at the 89 Batman and tell me that, like, something along the lines of Batman Begins was not possible. The 80s was full of gritty drama. Full of it. And on top of that, Year One was published when? 1983? 1984?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
And then, even though I'm not a fan of it, I think it's crazy schlock at best. Dark Knight Returns was 1986.
Yeah.
When was The Watchmen? I think that was 86.
Watchmen was, I think, 87 or 88, I think.
Yeah. But yeah, man, like, comics in the 80s, and it wasn't, you know, Batman was dark years before Dark Knight Returns, you know?
Year One.
O'Neill and Neil Adams, yeah, and Frank Miller did play a huge part in it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think it was Dennis O'Neill created, you know, the whole, the character of Ducard and all that stuff.
Yeah, right? The League of Shadows and stuff in the 70s,
League
of
Shadows, Batman having ninja training and everything, right?
Yeah, and Ra's al Ghul.
That all came around in the late 70s, and, the comic books were getting dark again, and it was getting gritty, and I mean, you just said, Batman Begins couldn't have been done in 1989.
It could have been done.
I'm just thinking now, and I've got a huge boner, I don't mind telling our listeners, thinking about if Michael Mann had directed Batman.
Oh, Jesus.
Because it would have opened up with Batman stopping a bank robbery where no less than 10 people got gunned down, got machine gunned down. You know, the scene when they break into Axis Chemicals would have had the, oh God, what's the thing called that they use in Thief to cut into the safe?
I don't remember.
It looks like a big stick of white phosphorus.
Yeah.
Oh, James Caan's ego. That's
yeah, James Caan's cocaine for the weekend.
Yeah, I just, you know, Batman for me, and I, this is kind of a flip-flop on last week, but Batman is my bad as well, and exactly for why I said, you know, like, the emphasis was taken off.
You thought about it after, didn't you?
I did, and I mean, I enjoyed it. Last time I went back to it, I did enjoy it, but I enjoyed it in spite of myself, you know, like, the last time I had watched it before that.
What would break first, your back or your spirit?
Well, I mean, you know, like, we had done the whole trilogy in theater. We had sat down and watched from Batman Begins to the final credits of The Dark Knight Rises in one sitting in a packed movie
theater. You were on Batman high.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I sit down and I watched the 89 Batman, and I was like, hey, it's not as bad as the last time I watched it, which was probably about a year earlier. I remember me and you sitting down to watch it and just laughing.
We sat down and watched it. No, because I remember we were up in Walmart. It was like $12.99, and you cracked and bought the awesome, it was one of those Warner Brothers Blu-ray case that they actually booked.
Yeah,
and those things are awesome, and Batman is a big enough hit to deserve it.
Yep.
Right. But on the other hand, if Batman's going to get it, Warner Brothers, give me my fucking Lethal Weapon. give me the original Lethal Weapon, big ass special edition it deserves. But yeah, no, we picked it up at Walmart, went back, turned it on, and I remember laughing uncontrollably the first time he does the arm raise.
Yeah.
And I was still laughing. I was still laughing at the, oh, come on, man, the bat.
Those guys are great. Those guys are great.
American
Johnny pops the walk-up roof. the guy who looks, he looks like Kevin Bacon's coke-addled younger brother.
Oh, no, you know what he looks like? He looks like Mickey Rourke's coke-addled brother. That's
and he's got that
like.
Really long ear piercing.
Yeah, it's like bait hook got caught in his ear.
You're looking at that, and I could tell that when they did the when they were doing the oh god, what are they called? I'm a fucking animator, and I can't remember that. The Ridley Grahams, the
thumbnail storyboards.
They were doing the storyboards. That character was definitely drawn to look like Kiefer Sutherland. Yeah, it's just, and that's another, like, oh man, the bat, everybody is overacting in this movie. Everybody.
But that works for the film, though.
Yeah,
I mean, look at what Anton Furst is doing in that picture. Look what Danny Elfman's doing in that picture. Everything in that film is up to, is turned to 11, except for Palance, who's on 947, and then you have Keaton, who's like, you know, playing a character.
Then there's Kim Basinger, who's just not doing anything at all.
Everything is turned to 11. You know, they've got the amp is pumped on everything except what it should be on.
Will also say it. I'm going to say it right now. Burton's direction in Batman sucks.
Oh, dude, the world's slowest car chase.
And the actors, man, like just the character interaction. It's like everybody is just waiting for their turn to speak. They're just waiting for the line read to end and then skip that beat.
It was like early episodes if they came from the north.
but still, that great...
Even worse, super early episodes of Blast Processing.
but still, that very memorable scene where the Joker finally sees himself in the mirror and stuff, you know, that's a memorable visual.
It's a memorable visual, but it's just so theatrical and so over the top. I just
But you're going to see a Batman film, remember? You're seeing a movie about a guy who dresses up like a bat and he fights a circus clown. A psychotic circus clown. But I mean, without Batman, there is no Batman the Animated Series. Batman the Animated Series, you don't have the masses of fans that turn out for, you know, Batman Begins.
Yeah.
In a certain way, like I said before, that movie is still very much influenced by the Adam West version, you know?
Yeah.
But it's at the time, they were like really trying to get away from that.
But at the same time, there's still a certain campiness in the movie, for sure.
And to me, and guys, that's like another thing. I don't have the nostalgia for the Adam West Batman.
Neither do I.
Right? And it's just, camp to me is something that doesn't belong in Batman.
But some days you can't get rid of a bomb, John.
They should have had a couple nuns popping up in the alley during the fight. That would have been pretty good. Instead of carts of cabbages or whatever the heck you hit with the Batmobile, which makes no sense as a vehicle to be driving in a city, even though it looks so cool. You know, if you have to make a turn with a grapple hook every like six blocks.
This summer I was driving around Ottawa, our nation's capital, which isn't nearly the congested hellhole that I imagine Gotham City is, considering I think Gotham is designed off of New York. And I couldn't get around city streets in a fucking Fiat 500, let alone a car that looks like it's 50 feet long.
But this is the thing. It's not. It's built off a 70s Corvette. It's built off a Stingray.
It just, I don't know, man. And again, that might be Burton with the Force perspective.
Yeah.
It looks enormous. The Batmobile looks enormous.
Yeah, again, it's all sets. Yeah. I mean, everything in that film is a set, right? City looks cramped.
And I have to make the comment that Freud would go crazy over that film.
Oh, and there's something we brought up last week. I feel I got to touch on it again. There's a lot in the 89 Batman. There are a lot of really awkward scene cuts as well.
It's just sloppy, man. It was put together.
The one that sticks out the most in my head is after the horrible scene in the museum.
Party man.
Yeah, look, we got a friend named Larry, and anytime we do anything, I'm sure to say, let's expand our minds. Lawrence? But, you know, after that whole horrible, I make art until somebody dies.
Oh.
And all that crap, and you get that awesome shot of Batman coming down through the skylight, and then that, you know, his stupid
and the music cue. The music cue.
But then he fires the grappling hook, and he and Vicky make the world's slowest escape from a group of hardcore gangsters who can do nothing but jump and try to catch him.
And then he all wear sunglasses at night.
Yeah. He turns around and throws a smoke bomb, and then they cut. You know, they don't show smoke bomb detonation. They don't, you know, they show the bad guys running out of the smoke afterward. But you don't see that he's throwing a smoke bomb. And that's just, it's stupid, but it's something that's always irked me, and it turns up all the time in that movie. It's just, it's really, really, really sloppy.
That's why Batman Returns is better.
Batman Returns reminds me of the last time I did shrooms.
here's the difference between.
We'll get to shrooms later, Steve.
But see, Gabe, you're making a comparison there between taking a painful cheese shit and taking a painful cheese shit that has less blood in it.
Oh, come on.
I think the difference between Batman and Batman Returns can be summed up in characters making escapes or getaways vertically. And in Batman, you know, you weigh a little more than 108, you know, oh really? And you know, the grapple gun goes up. Okay, so maybe he's making an attempt to adhere to some sort of physics, even though, you know, maybe not. And then you look at Batman Returns, and you got the Penguin on top of some roof, you know, who pulls out an umbrella, and all of the panels of the umbrella fly off, leaving wires, like six wires or something like that. And it starts to rotate, and you know, 160-pound Danny DeVito just flies up in the air. It's it's a complete departure from anything logical, scientific, and I love that about that movie.
Yes.
I love that about Batman Returns, and I feel that Batman is I have a soft spot for Batman. You know, I was, what, 8 or 9 or whatever that when that movie came out? You know, great stuff if you're a kid. You know, I remember going to my parents' VHS drawer, seeing, you know, a VHS tape that said Batman on it, being like, oh my God, popping it in the VCR and being sad as hell that it was the 1966 Adam West version, being like depressed for a week, you know, that it wasn't. That's how into Batman I was at that age. And Batman Returns was the first Tim Burton film that I had seen in the movie theater. And the first moments of that film when it's Pee Wee Herman and what's her name? Jerry, you know, from Pee Wee's Big Adventure, The Tour of the Alamo. She plays the
it's Adobe.
Yeah, exactly.
That's made out of clay.
Adobe. you know, they're playing what's his name? Cobblepot's you know, parents. You know, it's the snow, you know, which is a motif that keeps popping up in Burton films, you know, the Christmas thing, you know, and the music. Oh man, again, the music with Danny Elfman just killing it again, you know? And that's a Danny Elfman that's gone away. You know, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to say that I prefer the early, young Danny Elfman who's just ripping it up with this, brazen style of scoring, you know, just, you know, sitting on top of everything, you know, like telling, not just telling you, wringing your neck and shouting at you how you're supposed to feel, you know, like stabbing your ears with like children's choirs and like, you know, now you watch it and it's just sitting in the pocket and it could be composed by, I mean, maybe I'm missing something, you know, I'm sure there's some film score people out there that are, you know, what are you talking about, McVeigh? But, you know, I really think that, that again, and I said it with Edward Scissorhands, the thing that really makes, the Tim Burton experience click for me is the music and not so much the design as the music and that connection that those two have. And you see it in Batman and you know, and I've listened to those scores a zillion times, you know, like I love the Batman score. I love Descent into Mystery. Listen to that track over and over again.
Absolutely incredible.
Yeah. Get in your car in the fall at midnight and drive down a country road, you know, like
watching
these
go everywhere.
Yeah.
I remember when I first saw Batman Begins and I was like, man, where was the theme?
there were two great tracks on that soundtrack. There's Descent into Mystery and there was the one that plays when he's actually going up the cathedral at the end of it.
Yeah. And the original score, like the overscore or the overture is awesome.
Yeah.
That was a great companion piece to John Williams' Superman, you know, like different direction, different style. But they sit very comfortably next to each other on a shelf, you know.
So while we're on you, Michael, what would be your bad?
Oh, my bad. What did I say last week?
I don't remember.
Batman Returns.
I think the movie that I love Tim Burton and I'm very forgiving of Tim Burton. You know, Nightmare Before Christmas. I love that picture. I watch it every year. You know, Beetlejuice was really awesome as a kid. Rewatched it recently. Holds up great. All the practical effects. You know, but I want to talk about Ed Wood, you know, and I tried to, inadvertently started talking about it earlier by, you know, confusing the Eds, I think a little bit, but Ed Wood is a picture that is arguably, Tim Burton's best film, as far as cinema goes.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly the most, polished and, you know, it stands out as also as being one of those rare Burton films outside of Sweeney Todd that is not scored by Danny Elfman. It's actually a Howard Shore score there with Thurman and everything. And I think the issue is that why I'm listing it is bad. And again, for the listeners who were beating to death with this fact, it does not mean bad. It just means that I just can't get anybody to watch Ed Wood with me. I think I am as enthusiastic about Ed Wood as Ed Wood is about making a movie. And I just cannot for the life of me get anybody to sit through it for some reason. They just don't see it, you know? And
well, a black and white movie about a filmmaker you've never heard of, you know?
And that in itself requires, I mean, I remember seeing Ed Wood before seeing Plan 9 from Outer Space, and I'm a big Mystery Science Theater guy. I love bad movies. I mean, Birdemic is okay. Focus, Michael. Ed Wood is for me just Johnny Depp brilliant, absolutely insanely brilliant performance. I think it's my favorite Johnny Depp performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I might say by a full body length, you know. I mean, when that moment when he pulls out his fake dentures, you know, his fake teeth and he emerges, he's got the Angora sweater. I mean, everything about Johnny Depp in that movie is just amazing. The amount of enthusiasm that he pours into that role, that Ed Wood just cannot be stopped. He is a force of nature, you know, and, you know, I really think that movie, you know, I mean, I guess it could suffer from, you know, just being obscure subject matter, being a little, I guess, overlong or not too interesting for a lot of people. But for me, it's a movie that I can put on at any time and I start laughing. You know, it's got the regular stable of actors. It's got Jeffrey Jones as Criswell is like so spot on that it almost wants to make me forgive him for all the heinous things he's done in his personal life. And then no, I will not forgive him for the heinous things he's done in his personal life. But that's almost how good his Criswell is. If you watch Plan 9 and then you watch Ed Wood, I dare you to tell the difference between Criswell and Criswell.
Hell, I
you
still know, can't it's... forgive him for Principal Rooney.
Is it Edward R. Rooney or Edward J. Rooney? I forget.
I don't remember.
Oh, anyway.
Principal Rooney.
Yeah. Made me make a phony phone call to Edward Rooney. And then. You know, Ed Wood really is beautifully shot. Martin Landau is just great, you know, especially when you see some of his other performances and in comparison, you know, side by side. I mean, what he's doing with Bela Lugosi is just
brilliant,
you know,
absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, it really is. And that was an Oscar well deserved, you know, for that role, you know, in a who he brings pathos and at the same time makes him hilarious. Like, pull the strings, man. Pull the strings.
Pull the strings. Just
amazing.
I love him in the water with the mechanical octopus.
Let's shoot this fucker. Yeah. He shoots up in the car and comes stumbling out of the darkness. And they got the headlights. I mean, anybody, I make films, and anybody who's made a low budget film can watch this movie and feel good about themselves. You know, and I think that's. That's, I mean, they're lighting him with the headlights from their car, you know. I mean, Ed is so impassioned about his movie that, you know, he's facilitating this terrible habit, you know, this heroin addiction or whatever it is that Bela Lugosi, Martin Landau's character, you know, is suffering. But, you know, Ed loves him, but also, you know, does he love his work more? You know, there's so many good things that you can latch onto in that picture. You know, Sarah Jessica Parker, for instance. You know, just every scene that she's in is like, you know, she's really funny in this movie. And I know there's a lot of horse face haters out there, and she is just, I mean, give her a chance. Watch this movie. You know, she is hilarious. This movie, you know, everybody in this picture is really good. Even Doogie Howser's buddy is in it. What's his name? Max Casella, that's his name. He played Vinny in Doogie Howser. You know, Mike Starr is in it. Bill Murray. Murray's stealing all the scenes.
Oh yes, and Lisa Marie was probably the only person who could play vampire.
Yeah. She was perfect, actually.
That movie is a very funny movie. And again, I go back to Alan Arkin. You see flashes of the tone that he achieves. You know, where you know, either you get it or you don't. Style of, you know, deadpan. You know, it's just a film I keep going back to. And you know, I guess I am almost ruining the definition of bad by gushing over.
So. Yeah, you really have you get to pick two goods this week. That's not.
we could always say that, like, I really love Edward, but I mean, the main drawback to it, I'd say, is that it's kind of a fantasy because
it's not historically accurate at all.
Yeah,
in the least.
there are also, you know, I think the movie does kind of. I think it cripples itself in the screenplay department a little at times when it tries to go for that, you know, that Hollywood road more traveled. And yet, then you get it kind of button up against that. Every time the movie tries to go to, like, the mainstream biopic route, it butts up against that head wall, that breakwater that is Tim Burton, you know? and that kind of, like, it feels a little schizophrenic at times. You don't know if I think I did say it last week. It was like, Tim was really, he was going for it this time. He was really trying to make a movie that people would take seriously. He was trying to make, you know, this was his masterpiece. This was his life's work. This was his, you know, his shot at the big time, his shot at being a prestigious film director. And some of his sensibilities kind of did get in the way a little bit. Like some of his, you know, like making it all in black and white and then, like, just the nature of, like, in particular, Depp, at times, Depp's performance just goes a little over the top, you know? And
No way. How dare you?
It does.
Johnny Depp is perfect. Perfect in this movie.
He's great. I mean, I love him. I love him in it. But I have the same problem with Depp in this movie that I have with Depp in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. There are times when he just doesn't know how to dial it back a little bit to make it that much more convincing, you know, to really sell that character.
I mean, it's you know, the Burton kind of take on outsider, being an outsider.
Yeah.
In this movie, he gets to have a group of outsiders. You know, Johnny Depp plays Ed Wood as definitely an outsider who wants to be an insider.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and that's not the thing about it.
He's desperate.
Yeah. He really is, and it's unabashed. And you look at some of the other Burton outsider pieces like Edward Scissorhands and or look at Winona Ryder's character in Beetlejuice and you know, they don't seem to me, or Michael Keaton in Batman, or, you know, I mean, they don't seem to me trying so much as to fit in so much as Johnny Depp said would, you know, in this picture. You know,
the funny thing about that is he wants to fit in, but I at the same time he wants to be free to wear his Angora sweater.
Yeah.
Yeah, have his cake and eat it too. He wants to eat, you know, that scene somebody mentioned last week on the Lost podcast that what was it? The Orson Welles scenes with with Brain from Pinky and the Brain.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, I forget who plays Wells in Ed Wood.
Vincent D'Onofrio, I think.
Yeah.
But Maurice LaMarche does the voice.
And Maurice LaMarche is the voice. And all I can think of whenever I see that is my brain automatically goes to, what luck, there's a French fry stuck in my beard.
Rosebud. Yes. Rosebud frozen peas.
Yes. They're even better when you're dead.
Is that the critic?
Yeah.
Is that what
that
is?
And now for a little magic, I'll make this jug disappear.
All right. Well, for my bad, it's definitely a bad pick, and that is Mars Attacks. it's a very fun flick. As I mentioned last week, it's kind of a modern day equivalent to a movie like It's a Mad World.
Only but the it's vaporizations.
But it's such a clusterfuck.
good word.
That's a great word.
I mean, there's so much going on, and it's so chaotic. I mean, the main things that stay in your mind after you're done watching it are certain set pieces, you know, like them bowling with the Easter Island figures, or Sarah Jessica Parker's head on a dog. And I mean, there's just too much going on in this movie. But at the same time, I mean, it's such a parody of something like Independence Day that I can't help but love it. I mean, it's one of these entertaining flicks that, like, if it's playing late at night on cable, you'll watch it and you'll have a good time, but you won't think about it too much after it's done. But it's definitely a mess.
I love that whole, that pastiche, that 50s, you know, Martian invaders, ray guns, and yada, yada, yada. And I've given the movie more chances than it deserves, and yet for some reason I can never, I want to like it, but I can't.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a mess. I mean, it doesn't work. But yeah, there's not much to say about it, except one thing I mentioned is that I am a huge Jack Nicholson fan, and he's great as the president.
He really is.
But as the Vegas casino guy, oh man, that's probably one of the worst performances he ever gave.
Even worse than Five Easy Pieces?
Hey! Hey, Power, don't go there.
I'm only kidding. I'm just tormenting. I just want to see your response.
How about the fact that he managed to build an entire movie around Tom Jones being awesome?
Yeah, that's just... Well, I mean, that's not too hard. Tom Jones is pretty awesome.
It's still better than Jada Pinkett.
You ever see the episode of Top Gear with Tom Jones on it? He was badass.
You know, and this is one of Michael J. Fox's. Isn't this one of his last... films that's the one the imagery that I remember the most, you know, from this picture is the meeting for the first time with, I think it's Paul Winfield or whoever it is, and Michael J. Fox is the reporter. That whole scene is really, really funny with the skeletons and the, you know, the chaos that ensues, and I do remember that, and I do remember having a big laugh at that moment in the movie, and I was like, yeah, this movie's pretty good, and then it wasn't, you know, like right after that scene was done, you know. But the one thing I think that continually cracks me up are the voices of those Martians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that just cracks me up every time I hear it.
Act.
just so angry and just
and one of the funniest moments is like when they have this translator to translate the aliens' language, and all you hear is "I come in peace," and we come in peace, and they just start shooting at people while you hear "come in peace."
It's really funny. It's you know, funny in concept, not in execution.
Right? Well, there's some funny stuff sprinkled around in there, but it probably works better as a 15-minute short or something than as a movie.
It's really hard to make a big budget comedy. You know, it's got to be. You know
it almost feels like a Barry Sonnenfeld picture in certain ways.
Oh, why would you go there? It's true, though.
So, with that, we'll segue into our uglies, which is, to us, the worst movie that Mr. Tim Burton has done. And this might be as much a trial, as much and great fun as well. So who wants to go to the guillotine first? Heads will roll.
I'll do it. I'd like to take everyone back to the summer of 2001. A summer where everything seemed to open big and then just fizzle out the next week. And there was a movie coming out, a big budget remake of the...
drag this out as long as you can now, John.
I'm going to. I believe it was 1968. I can't really call it a classic sci-fi film, Planet of the Apes. And then, you know, I went to the movie theater, bought my tickets, bought my popcorn, bought my drink, sat down in the theater as the opening credits started, and my reaction was, holy shit, this was directed by Tim Burton? And the movie goes on, and it's just, it feels like an utterly soulless experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, it feels like nothing really happens. And outside of the great makeup effects on a lot of the apes, outside of Tim Roth and I think it was Cary Tagawa played the one who had turned traitorous against him.
And Michael Clark Duncan.
But yeah, like that's not a handful of them. It's horribly acted. The way they move drives me insane. You know, it's like the wire work when they're jumping around.
Yeah,
it's one of those movies. It didn't feel like a Tim Burton movie. And what's worse than that, it was really, really, really sloppy. Even sloppier than the 1989 Batman. But I think the worst crime it suffers from is just, and this is always a factor that helps into me picking what I think is a film as a filmmaker's ugly, is when I left the theater, I felt nothing. I felt absolutely nothing. I think it was Gary Oldman said, when you come out of the movies, you should feel like you got a rocket strapped to your ass. And Planet of the Apes, it just, I know I left and I had absolutely no feelings about it. I was bored.
I'm weird about Planet of the Apes. I saw it opening weekend, myself and Sarah, and you know, we both enjoyed it. We both came out of the theater like, yeah, that was pretty deadly. I enjoyed that. I liked how it unfolded. I liked the big showdown at the end. I thought the apes were done awesome.
The rocket was amazing during that last showdown was awesome.
I thought it was all pretty deadly. I thought it was a pretty good flick, but I've never really had any desire to revisit it.
Cause it's pretty bad.
I never really found it bad.
You didn't find Chris Christopherson bad.
There was nothing really there that was like offensively terrible, but there was nothing really there that was Burton either. You know, wow. The design was fine, the makeup effects were fine, the apes were fine.
Hey, no, that being said, I think the apes do have a spiral on their helmet.
Yeah.
And
either way, there was nothing there that was ridiculously offensive. It wasn't a whole, like, there's nothing about that movie's execution that was really flawed or bad. It was just complete ambivalence.
It's empty. Disposable.
I thought it was perfectly fine for what it was. You know, it was a big tentpole summer sci-fi release. It could have been directed by Tim Burton. It could have been directed by, who's that guy? Sean Levy or, you know,
McFarlane.
Yeah. It could have been directed by anybody. It was like, technically speaking, and like from a performances standpoint, and just in terms of execution, it was a perfectly serviceable movie.
No, it was not from a performance standpoint. Mark Wahlberg is terrible. Estella Warren is terrible. Chris Christopherson, if I ever see him on the street, I'm going to kick him in the nuts.
I think your reaction to this movie is a little over the top there, John. I think your reaction to this movie is a little Jack Palance.
You hear me breathing in?
You know who's not terrible in this movie? Helena Bonham Carter.
I was going to say, don't say Chuck Heston as Dr. Zaius.
Tim Roth. Tim Roth's awesome.
Tim Roth is awesome in Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
But yeah. I think Tim Roth and Helena Bonham Carter are the only ones who looked at that script and got it.
Well, right? Giamatti, I think, was good, too.
Yeah.
You know, no, like, Paul Giamatti has been good in exactly one movie.
What's that?
Ironclad,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Prince John.
And Michael Clark Duncan was great.
Mm-hmm.
I just,
may you rest in peace.
Yeah, they're really, like, there's not a lot there. As much as I want to be trendy and hip and cool and a hipster and bash that flick.
And all of those things you are.
Fuck you, hipster.
You are cool.
Fuck you. The reason I'm picking this as an ugly, really cool. It's for Tim Burton, is because you've got this guy who is visually instantly recognizable, has crafted something that just feels like he was sitting down and collecting a paycheck.
Because he was.
And that's
was
exactly what Planet of the Apes feels like to me, is that he was collecting a paycheck.
Well, he was brought in late.
What did he make after this?
Big Fish.
So that's a more personal film, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think Tim Burton is the kind of guy who needs to do the... take the 1980s Tom Cruise route where you do the safe picture to do the personal picture.
Tim Burton needs to do whatever the hell he can.
Yeah, I think he can do anything, right?
He doesn't need to take the Steven Soderbergh road.
Yeah.
Those two guys that have Tim Burton, Tom Cruise, what they do have in common is longevity. You know, and maybe, you know, and you're only in Hollywood at least, and Tim Burton's very much Hollywood. You know, Burbank, childhood and everything like that, you know, very much the embodiment of that, the outsider looking in on Hollywood, but is actually an insider. You know, he's been around a long time because he knows that, you know, your career is based on the last movie you did.
Yeah.
You know, like Planet of the Apes, I mean, I was salivating for that. I'm sure you guys were. I mean, The it looked cool, you know, the trailers look cool, you know, the makeup that, I don't know who did it, Rick Baker, whoever did that makeup did a great job, you know, so it looked good, you know, and I think that was the goal, you know, I know that the script was pretty bad, and I'm sure that they went into production on that without the whole thing finished, and, you know, I think the small miracle of it.
At least they didn't Matrix Reload and start shooting and then realize, into the first day of shooting, they didn't have a script.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like I think Burton did okay by this movie, and I am not a supporter of this movie. Let me make that clear. This movie stinks. But, you know, it's got good parts in it, and mostly those good parts belong to Helena Bonham Carter, the sexiest monkey that I've ever seen. I feel very strange about being attracted to her under all that makeup, because I know that it's Helena Bonham Carter, but also it's a monkey, so I don't know, very confusing, but, you know, I think that Planet of the Apes is a success for Burton, not because it was a good movie, but it wasn't an outright, like, awful, terrible mess that it could have been, given that, you know, it was a hit. Right, I mean, it made a lot of money,
if they crammed Tim Roth into a pair of striped pants, I would have liked it more.
my thing with it is the whole thing with Planet of the Apes for me is I put it kind of in the same area as Sleepy Hollow. Now, Sleepy Hollow is a much better film, but it feels like Burton doing mainstream. It feels like just, you know, a mainstream film. It just happened to be directed by Tim Burton. And as a mainstream film, I don't really think it's all that bad.
But at least Sleepy Hollow still feels like a Burton flick.
It has
Planet
those Burton-esque
touches. Planet of the Apes doesn't.
Yeah.
So, Steve, what would be your ugly then?
I'm changing my ugly again this week from last week. I believe last week I may have picked Dark Shadows, which is a terrible, terrible fucking movie. But I'm going to pick one that's going to be extremely unpopular, and you guys are probably going to boo. And I'm not even going to bother defending myself. I'm just going to say I really fucking hate Beetlejuice.
Oh.
I hate
it. No, wait. Silence, silence.
Is that a Citizen Kane clap now?
Yes, it is. That was a We Are Marshall clip.
I think it's an overwrought, horribly acted piece of shit of a movie. I really do. I think it's just quirky and weird for the sake of being quirky and weird. It's not funny. Michael Keaton's annoying. Winona Ryder is wood. The effects
are nice. Glenn Shadix is an abomination.
What's that?
Glenn Shadix is an abomination. Yes.
It's just, you know... Nice fucking model! Honk, honk. Ha, 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 ha! Ha, ha, that's so funny! Ha. You know, I hate the movie. Moving on. Who's next?
Michael. What's your ugly?
Actually, wait a second, Michael. Steve, did you ever have any of the Beetlejuice action figures?
No, I did not.
There we go. Let that sink in. Beetlejuice had action figures.
And it, really? it had an animated cartoon, too.
Which was
better than the movie.
Boring as shit.
I recently found a DVD of Beetlejuice on Super Sale, and they included a few cartoons from the series on the DVD, and I watched it. I enjoy it. I always enjoy Beetlejuice. I'm not gonna defend it, because it's you love it or you hate it. You know, it's that kind of. I mean, it's weird, the movie. You know, like it's. You know, but I do have to say those cartoons, the one at least one of them that they put on was pretty good. It's pretty imaginative stuff. You know, the other ones that they put on it weren't so hot. But one of them, you know how that goes. You know, sometimes they put all their muscle into one episode of a show or something like that. They put the right one on the DVD because I hadn't seen that show since I guess I was Saturday morning cartoon age. And I hadn't seen it since, and I watched it, and I was surprised at you know, because they spend a lot of time in Beetlejuice's realm or whatever it is. Nice. I don't know what you call that. Yeah, and there was some pretty weird stuff going on there that was, and some pretty adult jokes disguised as in a kid's show.
But it's,
you know,
it served no purpose. Just like the movie, you know, it's just a bunch of jokes strung together. There's no real relatable antagonist. There's no, and I mean, even worse with the cartoon is Beetlejuice was kind of the good guy in the cartoon. It was just
he's the namesake, you know, he's the most popular character from it. But
and if it were Star Wars fans would rip it a new one. But Beetlejuice fans love it. I don't understand.
So Michael, what's your ugly?
I'm going to have to go with... the later works are not so hot. I'm gonna pick on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
That's a bad one.
Which is where I think Tim Burton kind of lost me for a while. I mean, I don't like Alice in Wonderland. Didn't like Dark Shadows so much. I mean, I didn't hate them outright. They were just kind of I felt the way about them as I felt about Planet of the Apes. I didn't like Planet of the Apes. I did enjoy the ending of Planet of the Apes. I thought that was kind of fun, you know. Big Fish I didn't really care for. I know a lot of people love that movie. I didn't care for it too much. You know, I stuck with it. It didn't bore me, but I think Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, just those Oompa Loompa sequences, just really,
And Depp is shit in that movie.
Yeah,
he's pretty much Michael Jackson in that movie. And Michael Jackson, forgive me, Michael Jackson fans, but he's Michael Jackson as an older pedophile weirdo.
He's Wacko Jacko.
Yeah, Wacko Jacko, pretty much. You know, he's chewing gum is really gross. Chewing gum I hate the most, you know. And that's where you see the edges being frayed a little bit for the Depp Burton relationship, you know. Like, is he outstaying his welcome? You know, like, no, but I mean, it's definitely one of the and to be fair, I've only seen it once and I only cared to see it once. And that was in the theater, and it's, you know, maybe if I went back and rewatched it without having you know, I mean, like a lot of people, Willy Wonka in the Chocolate Factory was a childhood staple. You know, whether you like or hate that movie, you had to watch it as a kid. It was like childhood required reading or something like that, you know, like required viewing, you know. And that's, and, you know, it's fun. It's got the, you know, the punishment of, you know, the gluttonous boy and, you know, like the brat and all that kind of thing. I mean, there's lessons and whatnot, but I think that they were all lost on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Mm-hmm. All I can remember is just the, what's the fella's name that's playing the Oompa Loompa? He plays all of the Oompa Loompas, but
Deep Roy.
Deep Roy, yeah. I mean, could have done without Deep Roy. He made me laugh in parts, but I mean, just overall, that movie was just. I don't know what to say about it.
Like I said on the last podcast, it's like the worst kids movie that Robert Rodriguez never directed.
I like the first Spy Kids, you know.
Yeah, but you know,
it passed them, but yeah. It felt disposable. It felt. I did like the grandfather. I remember liking him, and I remember the kid not messing up, you know. And that's hard.
I really think it's one of these movies that I found worst in retrospect. Like, I kind of enjoyed it when I saw it, and then I thought about it, and I'm like, yeah, it's not so hot.
it's really not. I had didn't. You know, I was tepid best when I saw it, and then, it, like you're saying, you know, and time was not kind to it for me. Maybe, who knows, I'll revisit it, and if I'm lucky, you know, in a few years or something like that, and, you know, maybe look at it differently, maybe get it, maybe see what he was doing there, but, I mean, for the most part, that movie was just not at all enjoyable, mm-hmm. You know, and it just didn't like it. You know, what's weird is that the same year, The Corpse Bride came out, you know, and that's a Tim Burton film I can get behind. You know, I like it when he does animation a lot. You know, I think that's his big strength, you know.
Fetch me musket.
But for my ugly, I chose a movie that I hate with a passion. And that is Alice in Wonderland.
I actually don't find that bad. I think I'm insane.
That being said, I do remember you vomiting bile at the Microsoft press conference at E3 when Jive Soul Bro tried to convince everyone of his favorite movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Alice in Wonderland, my favorite movie. I just... I said it before, I'll say it again. Alice in Narnia is a pretty kick-ass. It has a pretty kick-ass.
Alice in Narnia, if C.S. Lewis went into a candy shop, ground the candy to a fine powder and sniffed it, and then gave Johnny Depp license to overact and be all over the movie for no reasonable reason, and then added pop psychology bullshit in there about finding yourself, and, oh, I just can't take it.
But you see, Gabe, part of the problem is you were going into Alice probably secretly hoping for American McGee's Alice.
And I love the book. I love the Disney adaptation. I love the American Maggie games, but that movie is not Alice in Wonderland.
No, it's not. It's Alice in Narnia.
It makes me want to retch. It's like it's really like it. Usually, Burton's movie look good. That movie looked like shit.
Yeah, it's really weird how much money they spent on that picture and how much they threw up on the screen and how much animator time went into that picture and how bland it is visually, you know? And it doesn't nothing. It stirs nothing in me.
You remember Jazz Jack Rabbit? It looks like Jazz Jack Rabbit.
Wow.
Wow. Oh, man, going old school.
I think the main reason I kind of like it is that final act, that whole big, massive epic battle at the end of it. And I'm like, you know, myself and Sarah are sitting down watching it on Blu-ray, and I'm kind of like, this movie looks crazy. I actually really like the look of it. I thought the look of it was pure Burton. But when it gets to the end and this big epic battle breaks out, I'm like, where the fuck did this come from?
Did you say pure barf, Steve? Did I hear pure barf? Yes, I heard pure barf. it's like, to me, it looks like one of those, a bit like one of those old serial ads you used to see on YTV all the time, you know, with the crazy colors and stuff.
Like the one where the kids are eating their honeycombs and then Andre the Giant tries to steal it from them. And for some reason, there's a robot.
To me, the only salvageable thing in that movie, once again, is Helena Bonham Carter's performance.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. She was very memorable. The little pig scene, I remember watching that over and over again on the internet, you know, just getting a kick out of that, and thinking that the movie might be good.
As much crap as Burton gets for casting her again and again, well, she's usually the best actor in those films. But yeah, I hate that movie.
Was it Alice in Wonderland where she was doing the really, really weird, like, lispy accent? Chewing all her W's and stuff? Or was that Harry
Potter? Say again?
That might have been Harry Potter. Maybe.
But yeah, I've always been an Helena Bonham Carter fan. I think she can do no wrong, so I'm not really objective about her at all.
She's the boss in Fight Club, yo.
But yeah, Alice in Wonderland, it's horrible. I don't understand how it made so much money. I don't even want to think about it. But let's go into our final stretch and get your thoughts about Tim Burton. Let's start with John.
Not my favorite director. But I will always give someone props for having their own unique style. And Burton definitely has that. I kind of think he layers, especially earlier on, layered on the, you know, kind of quirky, weird, but amicable, affable outsider thing a little too thickly. But, you know, Sleepy Hollow was the bomb. I guess I'm kind of mad at him after living 23 years of a lie and thinking I've really, really loved his Batman movie.
I'm between a rock and a hard place on Burton. And, you know, it's a situation where I hate his shtick with a passion. I hate the whole, you know, he's creepy and he's kooky, mysteriously spooky and altogether ooky, whatever, you know, the Tim Burton show.
No. I was going to bring this up last week. When you did this, it's mysterious and spooky, not mysteriously spooky.
Whatever. Either way, I don't give a shit. Do I look like someone who cares? Really? But it's just...
Does Tim Burton watch The Addams Family?
Oh, you know Tim Burton watched The Addams Family. I think that Tim Burton was raised by The Addams Family. I think they kept him in their kitchen cupboard or something.
Talking about paging Barry Sonnenfeld again.
Yeah. You know, he's just... He's this guy, and I mean, yes, the weirdness and stuff to a degree feels honest, but I think he almost pushes it that little extra step further, and he's very self-conscious of that fact. I mean, how can he not be after being in that business for so long? Like showing up at red carpet premieres with his hair tossed off everywhere. I bet, like, you know, it's like a Jeff Winger situation. Hey, Tim, how long does it take you to get your hair to look like it's just tossed off everywhere like that? You know, like... He's got to be aware of it. He has to be. And anybody who says he isn't is full of shit. Like, the guy is just so self-conscious of that image that he's created. And, like, he really tries to just push that weirdness so far over the edge. And that's a turnoff for me. But then, when he goes super mainstream, when he does something like Planet of the Apes or Alice in Wonderland, which Alice in Wonderland didn't look mainstream, but let's face it, you read that screenplay, it's a mainstream screenplay. And it ends with the big pitched epic battle between forces of good and evil. It's a mainstream movie.
But like when he does that mainstream thing, then he goes exactly the opposite. He offends the sensibilities that, you know, he's kind of built his career around. So there's no happy medium with the guy. About the closest he ever came to a happy medium was Sleepy Hollow. I'd like to see him do more straight horror.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like as a straight horror director, he could be goddamn brilliant. He could be absolutely brilliant.
You know what I would love to see Tim Burton do? And because ever since Mike mentioned Hammer Horror earlier, all I've been thinking about is the brilliant Western remake of Let the Right One In.
Yeah.
I would love to see Tim Burton do, not quirky, just do a straight-up vampire horror movie.
Something like that, yeah, something along those lines. Take
or see Tim or see Tim Burton do a creepy-ass ghost story.
Yeah, yeah.
Because exactly. I bet you he would knock that out of the park.
He could. He definitely could. Like, hand Bonham Carter and Depp their walking papers for a little while. You know, don't break up with them. Don't divorce them. But, you know, just say, hey, guys, I think we need to take a break. You know, get some good character actors in there like you did with Sleepy Hollow and make a decent horror flick, just a straight-up horror movie. And I bet it would be goddamn brilliant. I bet it would be amazing.
You get Harry Potter to do it. He loves doing those movies now, apparently.
He's practically Tim Burton himself.
What about you, Mike?
Tim Burton, I mean, I probably revealed after gushing after, you know, Ed, the Eds, you know, that I'm a big fan of the early Tim Burton stuff, you know, particularly Pee-wee, which we didn't talk about too much, but I know that movie forwards and backwards.
I love Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure is a 1980s staple.
Yep.
It really is, and anyone who hasn't seen it, go to the video store, tell them Large Marge sent you.
I think what I may even do is I may go back through the remnants last week.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and she hated Pee-wee. I think it's almost lost on a certain generation of people, you know, like I think it's one of those you had to be there things, you know.
Well, Pee-wee's, I mean, admittedly, Pee-wee's a pretty weird cat.
Yeah, and it's so not ironic, you know.
No, it's not played for irony at all. Surreality, maybe. Irony, no.
No.
Well, man, guys, Paul Rubens was one of those weirdo comedians in the Andy Kaufman vein.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know,
let's not go too deep into Pee-wee now. We're trying to wrap up.
it's so much fun.
It is.
So you know, I mean, Tim Burton, I think, I think without expressly stating it, you know, in his pictures, that I feel like he understands depression, you know, I feel like he understands depression and isolation, more than maybe some other, you know, outgoing filmmakers do. It's a strange, it pops up again thematically in his work. So it's something that I think he's interested in dealing with and probably, you know, I mean, the big thing about Tim Burton, the thing that endears him to me, a lot of his influences, I feel, are like bad films. You know, like I think he grew up watching a lot of bad movies. That's why he loves Ed Wood so much, and you know the bad science fiction movies. And you know, like you see a lot of great filmmakers out there, and you know they're stealing from other great filmmakers in order to make themselves great, and you see that all the time, and I feel like Tim Burton steals from bad filmmakers, you know, like it feels that way, especially lately, you know, with this latest, you know, the 2000s have not been. I'm looking at the list right now, and I like Corpse Bride, and that's I think about it.
Wait, you don't like Sweeney Todd?
I like the art direction in Sweeney Todd, but again, okay, so that brings me to the Tim Burton, Danny Elfman component, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
I think that's a great, one of those great collaborations, you know, Tim Burton and Danny Elfman, Peanut Butter and Jelly, John Williams, Steven Spielberg, you know, I think the Burton Elfman combo really clicked with me as a youngster. And, you know, I think that no matter what happens or what comes out with next, you know, I think the next thing that he's coming out as of this, you know, recording is Frankenweenie is the next one coming out. Mm. Very hopeful for that. I will probably see that in the movie theater. I tend to see all of his animated stuff in the theater. Again, I love the Nightmare, love the Nightmare Before Christmas. Know the whole thing by heart. You know, that is the soundtrack to Halloween and Christmas for me, much to my family's chagrin. And I think that mostly the bad influence of those bad film influences on Tim Burton, I understand that. You know, I love bad film, and I think that he's kind of he excels when he does animation. And I'm really hoping, I got my fingers crossed for Frankenweenie. I hope that he taps into the same, you know, magic that he did with The Nightmare Before Christmas and The Corpse Bride, with Frankenweenie. You know, I got my fingers crossed, guys.
The thing with me with Burton is that I'm also a huge fan up to around Big Fish and. And I'm like, my feeling with his recent work is that he's mostly phoning it in, and that he was great when he was still struggling and finding itself. And now that the people have accepted him and said, oh, Tim Burton, you're so great, he's just content to do whatever crap goes through his brain and like, oh, they'll eat it up, you know? He's not trying anymore. Almost as if he needs like a flop, you know, to try to find his inspiration again. Yeah.
Or his angst. Get his angst back.
Or he just needs a real, like, I really love Sweeney Todd, and I think that's a project that fit his, like, his mentality so well. So he just needs something, again, that just fits him, because all these Alice, just from the starting point, doesn't fit Burton at all. Neither does Charlie, neither does Planet of the Apes, you know? So yeah, I consider myself an ex Tim Burton fan. I'm a Tim Burton fan up to the 2000. I really love most of his movies up until then.
Yeah.
So that's it for Burton. Next week, we'll finally be discussing Richard Fleischer, director of The Vikings, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and Conan the Destroyer. Woo. Until then, see you next Wednesday.